Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Louis Nowram makes his inaugural appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known, I guess, to all of us, but he's many things. He's a playwright, a novelist, a screenwriter, a non-fiction writer. He's written memoirs. He's known for many things, I guess, including the play and the film Cosy, the memoir The Twelfth of Never, and the essay Bad Dreaming, which was a very influential essay that came out a couple of years ago. But tonight, Louis Nowram is here on the occasion of the publication of King's Cross, a biography, and he's going to speak for us on the topic King's Cross, its life and time. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Sydney Institute, Gerard and Anne and Janet. Thank you. You obviously sell a huge number of copies there. I'm going to talk about King's Cross, and you'll find out the reasons why the book is rather long and why I've tried to change the way people view King's Cross. I've been living there for about 25 years, and I don't think I could live in any other place. And so I spent a lot of time collecting information and then trying to write a book that indicated just how important King's Cross has been to Australia, other than the headlines. The name has become a shorthand for vice. When the media mentions it, the adjective is notorious, sleazy, red light, sinful, violent, dangerous, hellish, and other similar pejorative terms are needlessly attached, as if the reader has to be constantly reminded of its scandalous reputation. For nearly 90 years, King's Cross has been synonymous with crime, drugs, sex, violence, bohemianism, and immorality. It is the most densely populated area in Australia, with residents who range from the wealthy to the underclass, people who live in some of the most exquisite examples of Art Deco buildings, or sleep rough on the streets. Famous people have lived in the Cross, and others have become famous by living in the Cross. There's backpackers, junkies, whores, strippers, chefs, madmen and crazy women, beggars, booksellers, doctors, musicians, writers, gangsters, drug dealers, eccentrics, judges and artists, and even film producers. They live side by side. It is one of the most diverse and tolerant communities in Australia. For decades, it was a safety valve for our society and at the forefront of our nation's social and cultural changes. So much so that I'm making a claim that the history of Australia is impossible to imagine without acknowledging the contribution of King's Cross to modernity, female liberation, the art of living in high-rise apartments, and how it provided a refuge for those whose behaviour, ideas, ethnicity and sense of morality was, for many decades, at odds with mainstream Australia society and culture. It's strange to think that the area is so small. Basically, it's just 10 streets. And it's had such a profound effect on the national imagination, even though it's so small. It was Lieutenant General Ralph Darling, Governor from 1825 to 1831, who was to see the true potential of the Sandstone Ridge. He ordered that the land extending from Woolloomooloo Bay through Potts Point to Elizabeth Bay and southwards towards Darlinghurst Jail, where Darlinghurst Jail would be eventually built, would be divided into 17 allotments, with a minimum lot of 8 acres. It stipulated that the houses must cost at least £1,000, an extraordinary sum at that time. The first 7 land grants were made in 1828 and further allotments in 1831. The mansions built on a ridge, then called Woolloomooloo Hill, would hover above the stink, dirt and crime of the town down here. The villas looking down on the town would be a visual statement of the city's grandeur and a constant reminder of the gulf between the swells and toffs high up on the hill and the convicts and emancipists below in Sydney Cove. These were glorious mansions, impressive and imposing, with standards of luxury not seen before in Australia. But King's Cross itself was a result of an old man's dull pragmatism destroying a younger man's vision. Thomas Mitchell, the 38-year-old government surveyor, a brilliant man of incredibly volatile moods, knew the city would expand beyond the ridge to the east as we're heading towards Double Bay, and realised that the Aboriginal track that led up the hill, which is William Street, could become a glorious, broad avenue. In 1830, he sent his plans to the 63-year-old colonial secretary, Alexander Maclay, owner of Elizabeth Bay House. But Maclay disliked Mitchell intensely and opposed the scheme. He took the opportunity of Mitchell's long absence of surveying and exploring to change the plan so that the street ran straight up the hill on a much steeper gradient and stopped at the top of the ridge without crossing over it and extending down into Rushcutters Bay and then beyond to Bondi. Instead of the wide thoroughfare imagined by Mitchell, Maclay narrowed it. The result of the colonial secretary's self-serving interference was that King's Cross would become Australia's worst bottleneck, a Gordian knot of seven streets running into one another at the top of William Street, creating such a tangled havoc that the intersection became infamous for the traffic problem and accidents. You just have to see newsreels of the 1920s, 1930s to just see how disastrous this was. The solution only arrived in 1975 when the King's Cross Tunnel was opened. Much earlier, in 1916, the southern side of William Street was completely demolished to widen it to the width that Mitchell originally envisaged. The economic and social cost of both solutions was enormous. And I go into the book, the social cost was extraordinary. All this could have been avoided, but then self-interest nearly always defeats the visionaries, especially in Australia. As the 19th century wore on, economic downturns meant that the huge estates were subdivided and more people came to live on the ridge. Victoria Street became one of the most fashionable in Australia, its beautiful avenue lined with terraces and trees. Poorer people resided in the many boarding houses that were pervasive in the area, especially towards East Sydney. William Street became a buzzing, bustling thoroughfare. Still, the area didn't know what to call itself. Its official and unofficial names over the years have included Windmill Road, because it used to have windmills there, and anybody who's lived near Dalhousie Road can appreciate the afternoon, the wind blowing up. It was also called Woolloomooloo Heights and Dalhousie. The name was changed in 1897 to Queen's Cross to celebrate Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. Thinking that the name may be confused with Queen's Square in the city, the name was changed a few years later in 1905 to King's Cross, honouring King Edward VII. See, the important point is the name was never officially gazetted, so it was uncertain just what area was covered by it. What did it mean? At first, it only applied to the intersection of William Street, Dalhousie Road and Victoria Street. But it quickly became less a specific geological location than a fluid definition that could never be pinned down. The name morphed into the colloquial term, the Cross, not so much a real address, but as one whose boundaries were left up to the imagination of its inhabitants and fantasies of those who dreamed of visiting it. Now, this is important. Two things happened in 1912 that were to redefine home life in Sydney. Australia's first public housing scheme, called Daceyville, was built in order to remove people from the city's slums, east and across. It was a deliberate act of social engineering and also about improving the morality and respectability of the lower class. The same year, something else happened that was just as significant. The highest apartment building in Australia was completed, King's Clear at No. 1 Greenough Avenue, King's Cross. The spacious apartments were fitted with the latest American technology, such as telephone nets, intercoms, automatic lifts, and an open-air cinema on the roof. This is during the silent era. These two events were symbolic of the division between a life in the suburbs and inner-city apartment living. In the early 1920s, King's Cross was still a slow-moving hamlet, And on Darlinghurst Road itself, there were no restaurants, food stores, or hotels. However, by the middle of the 1920s, and this is an incredible growth in such a short time, the landscape of the area had changed dramatically with the construction of many apartment blocks, especially in Springfield Avenue, which looked like Knightsbridge in England. If one is to pinpoint one of the first moral panics about the cross, then it was during the late 1920s when women, wanting to be liberated from the stifling morality and domesticity of a suburban life, shifted into these high-rise flats. Mainstream Australians saw the flats as a denial of family life, and they were rumoured to be dens of depravity. The unsupervised mixing of single women and men in apartment blocks became a moral panic exploited constantly by the tabloids during the 20s and 30s, especially Truth's campaign against the immorality of flat life. But both women and men, high-rise living not only meant parties, but a loosening of sexual morality and a sense of freedom that the anonymousness of the cross gave you. You were anonymous. You, unlike the suburbs where you were known by people. And this gave people such a great deal of freedom. There may have been new, gorgeous Art Deco Manhattan-style buildings, but there were still the ramshackle terraces, divided up into many flats for those unable to afford the new apartments. The low rents and its location close to the heart of the city meant that King's Cross became a sought-after place to live for bohemians. As the writer Dulce Dima said of the cross in the 1920s, quote, "Its half-broke, sanguine, visionary world of artists and sculptors, poets, scribblers, holed up in basements, third-story attics, and any living crevice that was cheap." But it was booze that was to first determine the cross's reputation for crime and violence. Nothing's really changed, has it? Pubs used to open at 6 in the morning and shut at 11 p.m, but in 1916 a referendum gained an overwhelming majority of votes to close hotels at 6 o'clock. The era of sly grog had arrived, and it was to make the cross. Sydneysiders were prepared to pay inflated prices for their illegal alcohol. One of the consummate sly groggers was Kate Lee. Once a prostitute, then brothel owner, she had her man push handcarts up William Street to the cross, supplying thirsty drinkers and all the brothels in Callis Street and the original dirty half-mile, which was King's Cross Road. Lee's arch-enemy was an English woman, Tilly Devine, who on coming to Australia worked as a prostitute in Callis Street and on Bayswater Road. Her career as a brothel owner owned herself to a law passed in 1908, which criminalised street prostitution and made it illegal for men to operate brothels or profit from the earnings of prostitutes. The result was that women like Lee and Devine could own and operate brothels. It was a well-meaning law that just turned bad. The violence often broke out between the Lee and Devine gangs, battles between up to 30 men in streets like Callis Street, who hit, shot, slashed at one another in open warfare on the streets. A 1927 bill outlawed the carrying of concealed firearms and handguns. So, gangs took up the razor against each other. The following 4 years are being called, quote, the worst mob wars in Australian history. The razor attacks grew more frenzied, and between 1927 and 1932, there were over 500 victims. A law was passed sentencing anyone who unlawfully possessed a razor to a six-month jail term. Interestingly enough, the majority of people arrested for it were women. Women cut one another and cut their boyfriends a lot. The law worked, but the wars between the gangs and gangsters continued to horrify the public. And in 1936, and this is a crucial time, the incorruptible Sydney Police Commissioner, William Mackay, convened a meeting with Devine and Lee, and he offered them a deal. The police would go easy on sly grog sales and prostitution, but in return, both women had to agree to stop the gang warfare. Mackay had come to the conclusion the best way to restrict crime was to confine it to one area and therefore have it under control. This was happening in the rest of the world too. This is the way police were thinking. This was a pivotal point in the policing of King's Cross. From now on, morality was relative. Policing the cross would be done with the knowledge that the area was the one place in Australia where certain criminal activities would be tolerated in order to stop their spread into the rest of the community, especially the suburbs. As events would prove down the decades, The elastic morality of the cross would corrupt many a policeman. But beyond the dark lanes, King's Cross itself was to become something special during the 1930s. It became the vanguard of cutting-edge architecture, neon lighting signage, plus a focal point of all things modern, innovative food, ethnic diversity, painting, technology, music and interior design. By the late 1930s, the Cross was said to be home to about 60,000 people in an area of barely 1 square mile, and had the reputation here and overseas of being Australia's Soho or Mont Blanc. The growing population needed places to eat, as many of the kitchens in the new apartments were small or non-existent. Does someone want to answer the phone? Or is it The area became celebrated for its cafes and restaurants throughout Australia, with one reporter asking rhetorically, "Is it not a legend that no one in the Cross can cook?" And what a thrilling range of cuisines to choose from. As one admiring witness wrote, "You can eat in 9 languages up in the Cross." English, American, French, Swiss, Russian, Chinese, Mexican and Hebrew. But what the range of food tells us is that the ethnic mix was like no other place in white Australia of the time. Here were people from all across the globe. As the Nazis rose to power in Germany, many refugees fled to Australia and sought out King's Cross because it was the most tolerant and cosmopolitan place in the nation. Or as contemporary locals said, the refugees made their home in the only part of Australia that could truly be called growing up. There were so many Jews that some newspapers reported the Cross was threatening to become a Jewish colony. The Cross became a fashion hub with frock shops, dozens of dressmakers and many dry cleaners. For the visitors, there was added frisson to spot Bohemians who had become synonymous with the area. Middle-class women flocked to the flats. It was also a haven where unmarried couples could live together. Let me tell you, reading about it, this was very important to a lot of unmarried couples, that they could live together across without anybody judging them. And it's also one of the few places where homosexuals were tolerated. To others, it was a fantastical place, a bewildering mix of people where, quote, as one reporter said, "All life therein is self-contained. When a man presents a visiting card that features King's Cross, he may be a governor's aide, a gunman, a gigolo or a garbage contractor." And you know it was written by a newspaper person because of all the alliteration. Since the 20s, there had been an increasing sense that King's Cross made the rest of Australia seem staid and parochial. But it was more than that. Locals saw their area as an island, a refuge that was isolated from the Puritan values and cultural desolation of the suburbs. They felt separate. As many of them did say, "We were different from the rest of the country." In other words, King's Cross had become the most vital, dazzling and sophisticated place to live in Australia. During the Second World War, 1,000 American servicemen spent their leave in King's Cross. Their presence meant brothels, prostitutes, illegal alcohol and so-called charity moles, those who had sex with them for free. None of you here? Australian women adored romantic Hollywood movies, and the American servicemen seemed to personify that. They had more money than an Australian man, more satira style, and actually gave flowers to their dates. No wonder women poured into the Cross, as did teenage girls to such an alarming degree that girls' homes and orphanages were ringed and barbed and had barbed wire so the girls couldn't get out. My mother came from Melbourne at the age of 16 and a half of precisely that, and she was so proud of the fact she made 2 American servicemen go AWOL for her. Just another chink in the bed. Once the Americans left King's Cross, it seemed to lose some of its vitality. Sure, it still had a vibrant nightlife and thousands loved living there, but the 1950s was a stagnant era, even in the Cross. Few new restaurants opened, actually 2 in the whole decade. The neon lights seemed less bright, less magical than a decade before, and also during this decade, only 1 apartment block was built after about 20 had been built in the 20s and 30s. But something was beginning to stir in the early 1960s. The Cross began to flourish as a chic nightclub and restaurant scene. Hotels like the upmarket Chevron Hilton played host to famous international performers like Frank Sinatra and Sarah Vaughan. Restaurants like the Chelsea and others became the epitome of high dining. As usual, there was also the undercurrent of the forbidden, which is part of the cross, which was prostitution and gambling. Plush illegal gambling casinos operated with almost impunity, catering to Australia's second obsession after alcohol, gambling. But it was Abe Saffron who was to recognise a trend before practically anyone else in Australia when he opened up the first legal striptease show at the Staccato in 1959. It was immediately successful. It would seem tame now with choreographed acts and less bare skin than you see on Bondi Beach. But it was the beginning of the commercialisation of sex, with Saffron making a fortune, actually millions, in distributing pornography across the country. King's Cross was openly pushing the boundaries of conservative Australia, not only in matters of sex, but sexuality. It had always been a place which gays escaped to, and the camp scene at the time was very large and internationally well known. In the early 60s, Lay Girls opened. At first, the idea of female impersonators was shocking, but gradually became one of the must-see visits for tourists. For many who came to live there, the Cross allowed one's personality and eccentricities to flower in an atmosphere of unique tolerance. And this is very important across the idea of performing self. For example, the black singer, Nellie Small, could do what she couldn't do elsewhere, and that was to be able to walk around dressed as a man. Bea Miles, a plump, rumpled figure who quoted Shakespeare for money and was the bane of taxi drivers' lives, could only have been allowed to exist in the Cross. She would have been locked up anywhere else. And there was the self-proclaimed Witch of King's Cross, Rosaline Norton, whose theatrical demeanour, makeup and chiseled teeth scared some and amused others, but who became so well known that people came to the Cross just to stare at her. And there's a film called The Glittering Mile made in 1964 where you can actually see people just staring at her. By the early 1960s, there were traffic jams of a Friday and Saturday night in the Cross, and it had over 800,000 visitors a year. And when you see The Glittering Mile, a documentary, say, in 1964, you sense there was an elegance and a sense of occasion in the visit of the Cross. But near the end of the 1960s, it became the epicentre for cultural and social convulsions. For the second time in its history, it was invaded by Americans. From 1968 to 1972, 280,000 American servicemen came to the Cross on R&R. They were to change the area in several significant ways. The first was these boys had no interest in upmarket nightclubs or cuisine. Restaurants went downmarket and strip clubs flourished, and the acts became more tawdry. But the most insidious influence was hard drugs, especially heroin. Few Australians were addicts before the Yanks arrived. You can literally count them on one hand. But many had become so by the time they left. And young people were coming into the Cross, escaping from their families as the generational divide widened in the 1960s. Many turned to drugs and then to selling their bodies to pay for them. Ted Knopfs, who opened the Wayside Chapel in 1964, was one of the few to recognise what he was to call, quote, a horror movie in slow motion. As the drug culture took hold, later escalating with LSD and prescription drugs, especially like Mandy's and all those other drugs. He warned the police and politicians, but they ignored him for about 7 or 8 years. They had no idea what was happening. The 70s was a hideous time for the area. 90% of houses, you've got to remember, 90% of houses and terraces in King's Cross Road were demolished to make way for the tunnel because of the Colonial Secretary, Alexander McKay. One of the most brilliant examples of Italianate buildings, a row from 1 to 13 Elizabeth Bay Road, were torn down. They were exquisite. When you see what they look like and how they would enhance the area now, you'd almost weep. But the worst carnage occurred in Victoria Street when the developer Frank Thiemann brought up many buildings wanting to tear down the terraces and put up cheap apartment blocks. In his fight against unions, students and local protesters, he had on his side the corrupt premier, the corrupt police and criminals. It was a violent and vicious team. Protesters were beaten up, threatened with death, and two women died in the cause to stop the demolition. One in a deliberate fire, and the other, Juanita Nielsen, was murdered on July the 4th, 1975, on the orders of the gangster, Jimmy Anderson. Although the protesters won, it was at a cost. Many of the destroyed buildings had to be demolished, and a series of crass, ugly apartment blocks sprung up at the northern end of the street. but it showed just how closely criminals, the police and politicians have become. Abe Saffron had been the major catalyst for this. He bribed premiers, the police commissioner and politicians of all persuasions. He was a malignant and destructive force. It's no wonder the tabloids began to call King's Cross the kitchen of hell. By the 1980s, the distinct difference between day and night began to blur. Whereas before, locals would go about their business of the day and leave the night to tourists and visitors so that the two worlds didn't intersect, now they did. Druggies overdosed in the street, thugs menaced you over daytime, and hookers became more aggressive because of their need for drugs. Prostitutes as young as 13, both boys and girls, became common. Really common. Most prostitutes, male and female, were under the age of 16 at this time. Pedophiles range freely, whether picking up kids at LL Main Fountain or at sleazy clubs like Costello's and Callot Street. The police themselves dealt in bribery, blackmail, drug selling, fake evidence and money laundering. They spent much of their time taking money off dealers and hookers and getting drunk with criminals at the Bourbon and Beefsteak. By the middle, I used to watch them and just go, oh, I can't believe this is happening. I've been robbed and you're not coming to... And the police would go, no, we're a bit too busy, we're getting drunk. That's true. By the middle 1990s, the Cross had become unruly, ungovernable and corrupt. Only the 1995 Wood Royal Commission and the police force managed to stem the sordidness and the corruption of the King's Cross cops. I used to work in a building called Minton on the corner of Bayswater and Darlinghurst Road, and every Friday a dozen cops would come up the stairs to get their bribe from the drug dealer. I had a table like this, and he had all the envelopes laid out, including some cocaine if the cops wanted it. That's how obvious it was. By the turn of the century, the Cross was in dire straits. The striptease clubs like Porky's and Stripperama had a decline in patronage because, quite simply, the rest of Australia caught up with the so-called sexual revolution. And men especially didn't have to come to the Cross for sex because prostitution moved to the suburbs. Lay girls became such a safe institution that it played in the suburbs and RSLs. The internet supplied porn, and so sex shops began to close. Even the iconic Pink Pussycat strip club closed. Tourism had stalled after 9/11 and hotel rooms were empty. The city of Sydney decided to revitalise and transform the Cross. In the space of a few years, one hotel after another closed. By 2006, over 2,000 hotel rooms had converted into almost 1,500 apartments for more than 2,500 people shifting into the area. And that was 7 years ago, so you multiply. It was a huge demographic shift. The newcomers were cashed up professionals, both straight and gay, young couples and empty nesters. It was a transformation as dramatic as the boom in apartment living during the 1930s. The area became a 24/7 entertainment district based on an alcohol-fueled economy. There may be posh restaurants, especially down in Macleay Street, but the thousands of people who pour into the area over a weekend want to drink and party. Many young people came to the Cross to drink themselves into insensibility, drop ecstasy or take speed. Bikers have taken hold in the nightclubs because they sell the drugs and they make extra money from standover tactics. As has happened over the decades since the 1920s, the Cross is still the site of moral panics, especially when two young men in separate incidences were king hit in Victoria Street and died. Hysterical politicians and the media call for a curb in the opening hours of hotels and bars. What this panic failed to mention was this wasn't only a problem at King's Cross. As usual, it was blamed for the changes in our social attitudes and behaviour. But these sort of violent actions also occur in the rest of Australia and some places even more frequently. But the Cross has always been a convenient scapegoat for our baser desires and actions. The demographic change has meant high prices for flats and food. Bohemian artists who were once a feature have shifted into cheaper areas like Marrickville or Surrey Hills. Residents have always understood that the Cross stood for values different from mainstream Australia. But now the people from the suburbs are shifting in. This tolerance and a sense of diversity is withering as the newcomers aim to rid the area of its danger, edginess and difference, remaking the Cross in their own bourgeois image, Because you've got to understand, before that, when people came to the cross, they wanted to be changed by the cross. They wanted to be changed by the people they met. They wanted to be changed by the food. They wanted to be changed by everything. That's why they came to the cross. The difference with this demographic shift is these people are coming in wanting to change the cross in their own image. And that's been a huge difference. And it's inevitable that the area will be tamed. It was once a dangerous place, not so much for its criminal activity, but because it was the id of Australia. And that's why it was and still is feared. The cross permanently undermined the myth of the upstanding Australian, a person of strong moral values, a paragon of normality and suburban rectitude. The cross offered instant gratification, sexual immorality, neon-lit temptations and illicit pleasures. It appealed to the unruly desires of the id. What made Morrow's furious was the cross excited passions and loosened self-control. Morrow lines were crossed as one slipped from the unambiguous morality of mainstream society into a vague immoral zone where few things were forbidden and temptations were everywhere. Perhaps the cruel reality is that King's Cross to serve its purpose. For decades, it was a vanguard of modernism, sexual mores, music, art, design and nightlife, an escape from the parochial and Puritan Australia. But now all that has changed because the rest of Australia has caught up to King's Cross and it's no longer needed as it once was. Thank you.
Many thanks to Louis Nara. We'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. First, I should say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for providing this fine facility this evening, and the facilities are open downstairs for a bit after we finish. And I should also say, as a reminder, that Louis Nara's talk that's in the interview coincides with the publication of King's Cross biography. So let's go to questions and discussion. You don't stand here and talk to the back of the room as usual, but tell us about the other side of King's Cross. I mean, you've mentioned sin and sex and drugs. And did anyone ever go to church on Sunday at King's Cross? I mean, was there another side to the cross that
there
you don't
no church.
I forgot to mention, King's Cross is a pagan area. And in fact, there was a little church, a Methodist church, which Ted Knopf took over, but no churches in King's Cross. St. John's down the road. That's Darlinghurst. Sorry, it's above William Street. And I know, I got married there. But you know, when we had the reception, we went into King's Cross to Bayswater Brasserie because there was nothing there in Darlinghurst. And in fact, that's right down the other area. I'm talking the main area.
We've never had so many interjections at the Sydney Institute for the first question.
Oh, that's good.
There's a raffish crowd down the back.
Led
by Peter Coleman, I suspect.
All right. Raffish or raffish?
Well, depends which side of the cross you come from.
We say raffish.
Oh, we say raffish.
Yes.
Well, I came from Melbourne. Wait, right. No, hang on. I'm running this.
All right. Right.
Yeah, down the back. Yeah, down the back. Yes.
Yeah.
Just speak up a bit, will you?
I go to Wayside Chapel every Sunday. I'm from New York City, and to me, it is the epitome of Christianity. They welcome everyone, and it is just the most wonderful, wonderful Christianity experience.
Well, if you read the book, you'll find that at Ted Knopf's, when he started, I think they tried to excommunicate him about three times because of what he did. And the great thing about Ted Knopf's was that he was the first to recognise, it was almost his second or third night when he was in the cross and the Wayside Chapel, it was a disaster, almost derelict building, when the first of the dead bodies started to appear from drugs. And in the space of 5 to 6 years, he buried 150 young people because of drugs, and still the government would pay no attention. And he was an incredible man on that level. But people just thought he was just a do-gooder. But he understood it with a generational divide and what was happening with the drugs. That it was more than drugs, it was prostitution, it was everything. And some of his workers would go into bars to try and save young kids, and one was stabbed for example, because the pimps could make a lot of money out of the young girls and young boys.
Peter Coleman?
Yes, I must start by saying how much I enjoyed your book. I think it's a terrific book, as was the earlier one in the gutter. So I'm on side, and if I have this criticism, it's only because you said it tonight. You referred to the corrupt premier, obviously Bob Askew, and Thieman. And I knew Bob Askew pretty well. I wasn't facing him. But what you say about him as corrupt is what everybody says. It's so widespread that it will, I think, never be challenged or undermined. I don't believe. I think there is no evidence. He was obviously a rough diamond. And he was a gambler and all sorts of non-respectable things. But I do not believe he was corrupt on the way you and so many other people say. There was a tremendous movement everywhere to redevelop, to build...
It was the 70s.
And that was going on when he was premier. It seems to me quite wrong, unless you have good evidence, which I don't believe is there, to say it was due to corrupt decisions on high.
So just before we get to the answer, just for the podcast, Peter Coleman is suggesting is there is no evidence that Premier Askin was corrupted. Do you have any evidence
to suggest that he was corrupted? Including personal meetings with Abe and Askin, and they used to have personal meetings. And actually, Askin used to go Abe Saffron with the Premier. And not only that, but the Premier went three times to Abe Saffron's to have dinner. Now, you have dinner with a criminal, a gangster. This Abe Saffron was a thug. He was evil. The more you go into it, he used to stand by when he had girlfriends and have them beat up because they'd screwed some other guy. He was a monstrous man. And the same thing, the police commissioner went about a dozen times to have dinner with Abe Saffron. Now, that's just the beginning. And if you think it was just friendly talks about just the Premier meeting one of the most corrupt gangsters in Sydney, I feel that there could be a little bit of a relationship happening between the two of them. I don't know about that, but...
So hang on, we'll hear Peter, because it's an interesting point. What Peter's saying is, what evidence do you have? I mean, maybe he met Saffron three times, but what evidence is that he was corrupt?
No, I had dinner at his place.
What evidence is there of that?
I'm not going to debate it here. I have hundreds and hundreds, almost thousands of pages of files. You see how thick that book is, and I had to cut it down. I can send it to you, but here I'm not going to debate it. Really, it's silly because you say I say it's silly.
Okay, there's a question here.
All right, look, I'd like to thank you for feeling cosy.
All right.
I took my son, who has a serious mental illness, there, and he loved it. And at the end of the showing at the cinema, he stood up and cheered.
This is about COSI, which is about mental patients. I used to work in a mental institution, and then I started writing for politicians with no difference. And there was literally no difference. The madder they were, the more they were politicians. And one of the things when I wrote COSI, which was about the time I worked with mental patients, was I was very afraid that some people would think that I was laughing at the patients. But at the final preview of the first performance of COSI, we invited patients from Callan Park, and they just adored it because they realised that we weren't laughing at them, that was how it was. My reaction to doing it was I hated those films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest where silence, everybody's always screeching and going mad. It wasn't like that when I was there. You know, pills were great. The lifting was fantastic. They'd be really quiet, a little bit sweaty, but it was a different environment, and I didn't like that whole historical thing that films do. Yeah.
Same.
Brief statement, which you don't have to answer. But where did Mrs. Askin get the $3 million that she left to the cat home?
I don't know where Mrs. Akin got the $3 million for the cat home, but it's the same as John Ibrahim's sister who actually had $5 million in her ceiling. I don't know, and she didn't know where that came from either.
Why don't you deal with the penumbra around the area? Clearly there were significant influences across on Darlinghurst, which has become the gay centre, on Potts Point, which has become a very upmarket high-rise area, and clearly in the other two directions as well. Why do you narrow it to such a small area?
Well, I decided that if I went beyond William Street South, I was going to enter in Darlinghurst. It was going to be about Darlinghurst Jail. It was going to be about St. Vincent's and everything. And I decided to just narrow it to those streets that really Kenneth Slessor, I write about Kenneth Slessor, the poet. He was my god. I was competing with Kenneth Slessor, and he wrote brilliantly about the cross. And the streets that he writes about, the 10 streets that I write about too, which is what you conceive is the cross, but it's about a state of mind and about the people. If you go to Darlinghurst beyond William Street, it's much more strongly gay, 22% are gay, whereabouts Potts Point, it's only 19.
And Paul Keating.
Don't mention the actress he's involved with.
You talk about King's Cross and Sydney's Earth, but that's been lost basically with the influx of yuppies and the change. What do you think that means for Sydney? The human urban hasn't disappeared, so what do you think that means for Sydney, that it's no longer a
There's no longer an area. You see, one of the crucial things, when you go down to Melbourne, and I'm from Melbourne, you go down to St Kilda, and the police definitely push everybody, the druggies and everything, into St Kilda because you can contain it. Now, it's interesting, Clover Moore, with this whole thing about alcohol, said if the pubs have lockout at 1:30, it means that everybody's going to go down to Surrey Hills and Marrickville to drink. She was precisely against that because it goes back to the policy of the police commissioner in 1936. If you have it in one area, you have to tolerate it, but it's in one area and the police can govern it. Once it gets out of control, the police can't govern it. So essentially what you have is this sort of moral kind of uneasiness. And the same thing as the injection centre. Here you have the injection centre and you can be arrested for drugs before you get to the injection centre. But when you're in injection centre and shooting up, the police aren't allowed in unless they're invited. So it has a curious hypocrisy. But at the same time, you can control those people because you know who they are. They're all being filmed and everything. Who goes into the injection centre? And let me tell you, there's a lot of middle-class people from the North Shore.
Yes, question here. Yeah.
Juanita Nielsen, you mentioned, you said there was another woman in that development.
Yes, it was an Aboriginal woman, and what had actually happened, the Tufts, who the Premier and Police Commissioner had got, their whole thing was to go in with sledgehammers and slash up so that those people who were protecting the building, like Anne Summers, feminist, protecting the building, they'd get scared. Now, what actually happened was this Aboriginal woman and man went into one of the derelict terraces. These thugs set fire to it, and she was afraid of fire. And so the other guy, the homeless guy, ran downstairs and said, "Come downstairs." She's so afraid, she burnt to death. And it was the thugs that deliberately set fire to it, because that was a whole policy, not a demolition, but setting fire to the building so that they'd have to be bulldozed.
And can I just make a comment that at least Mrs. Askin didn't leave the money to a cat house?
Yes, a cat house. A whore house? Cat house. Oh, look, I'll have to say one thing about cats, pussies. It used to be that when the hookers would approach you, especially in the 80s and 90s, it was always, "Do you want a lady?" And I'd always go, "Yes, please, could I have a lady?" Because I'm really ugly and everything else like that. But lately a woman just came up, "Pussy, darling?" So they've changed the whole thing now.
You mentioned briefly Kenneth Slessor, but the wonder of the cross was also that some of our greatest poets or writers, artists, whatever, belonged to the cross. I'm thinking of Jessica Anderson and Chris Kosh, among others, and many more besides. Can you give us a bit of flavour of those? I mean, you said that you could be anonymous. On the other hand, it has a village feeling of creative artists, a bit like a Soho or a...
You have to understand that in the 1920s, where the Bohemians first became famous, the Dulcie Demas and all others never wrote about the cross. Dulce Dima wrote about the gladiators and generally 15-year-old girls coming into adulthood at the time of Christ or whatever. It was only retrospectively they wrote about it. The person who changed all that was Kenneth Slessor. You've got to remember the poetry in the late 1930s, was all orientated towards a landscape, this dreadful thing about Australia. It's always constantly about this damn landscape and sheep and stuff and gum trees. And even though they lived in the Cross, they'd still write those poems. And Kenneth Slessor, basically in his famous William Street, is basically going, no, it's the neon lights. It's this. And what you've got to understand about high, what was so important to these young people in the 1930s, they'd never had height before. They never lived so high up. And so Kenneth Slessor, some of his best poems are about being delirious about this height. And you could look down on people, you could look across. Australians never had height before. And that's the only. And you've got to remember that King's Cross is high on a ridge. It's actually higher than you think. And so you could just see everywhere. And the Mansions Hotel used to advertise itself as the highest hotel in Australia because of this whole thing about height. And when Kenneth Slessor started to write about King's Cross, you see, what it was, he was a very cold man. He wasn't a lyrical poet, but he loved the cross because it made him connect with other people. If he'd lived in the suburbs, he wouldn't have connected with anybody. And that was his whole thing. You connect and you never look down on anybody. You are part of this Canterbury Tales of life in the cross. And then later, what actually happens, you get the Jessica Andersons. And you've got to remember that three of Australia's best female novelists all lived within a couple of minutes of one another in the 50s and 60s. And that was very important for them to get together rather than being in the suburbs. So everything operated. But the one thing about bohemianism, again, talking about hypocrisy, bohemians are the greatest hypocrites of all because they savage middle class people and middle class life and their values and everything, but they want their money. So the middle class would buy their art or their poems, and that was a constant thing with bohemians.
There's a question here.
There's someone in the audience whose father owned the Mansion Hotel or ran the Mansion Hotel.
Grandfather,
there we are. Oh, Hotel Mansions or Mansions Hotel?
The Mansions Hotel.
There you go. Yeah, so he did. It changed his name subtly.
Yeah. The American officers used to stay there, and he did a roaring trade in Slidewell.
Oh, yes, there's a wonderful story about a woman holed up there in 1945, and her husband was a traitor. And she tried to commit suicide there at the mansion. I write about it, but it was a fabulous hotel. Fabulous hotel. Now, of course, it's apartments.
It's a bar. It was a bar below apartments.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, it was a beautiful hotel. Now it's apartments, of course. And you know how they sell it? Real estate agents have never heard of the word King's Cross. It's always Potts Point, Willamaloo, or anything. So the Mansions Hotel, they say in big signs, it's a Potts Point experience.
Hang on. Yes, here.
Hi, I've had the pleasure of living in the area for the last 25 years, and previous to that, it was always up on the North Shore. And it's been an enormous change, which has been greatly stimulating and making the thing that's kept me going is living in the area.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Now, one of the things that I wanted to say, I ran an American company for many years, and I used to have a boom in executives wanting to come to Sydney to see our operations because of being able to stay in King's Cross area and have a pleasure that they never had in any other place in the world.
Yes, it was always, and King's Cross was famous. I must say one thing, I've taken a few groups on tour of King's Cross, and they're all of a certain age, and a lot of them go, I used to live in the cross, but the cross is different. The whole thing about the cross, everybody said it, Kenneth Slessor's always said, it's changed since I was young, it's changed since, because King's Cross is about being young. It's about your experiences in your late teens, in your 20s, and you come to the cross, and the course of that's changed because you've changed, you're growing older. But every generation finds its own value in the cross, and then later they come back and go, it's changed.
I think, blame the Americans on R&R for bringing heroin to Australia through the cross. Do you think if they hadn't been coming, they'll be moving spares?
No, it would have. No, Australia was always a bit 5 years after the Yanks. Obviously, we were going to get it because we were fighting in Vietnam too, and the whole thing about drugs coming from Asia was going to happen because, quite simply, with the bourbon and beefsteak and everything, they were quite willing to deal in drugs because it was CIA influenced coming in. But no, we're just a little bit late. There was only one doctor when Lenny Bruce came to Australia. He was a heroin addict. This is just before R&R. There was only one doctor who had heroin, and he was in Orwell Street. So he would give Lenny Bruce the heroin. So there's only one doctor who would be able to do that. And the doctor himself was a junkie who lived to 82 years old. Pure heroin, you see, you can live a long time.
Do you see any solution?
I don't know what to do about ice. I've been attacked twice. The worst thing is when you see what's doing to their bodies, the scratching, the blood and everything else like that. But it's the temper tantrums that you can't deal with, and they're really they're unpredictable, and it's a dangerous drug, is because you never see them happy on it. Whereabouts if you're stoned, you're happy. You see, my whole concept would be that instead of alcohol, if everybody was stoned in the cross, everybody would be really happy going, "It's okay, man, you know, it's okay, you know, I don't want to hit you, I want to kiss you, you know, let's go and watch Family Guy again." You know, I've always thought the stoners would be fantastic, you know, to take over the cross. It'd be very laid back, it wouldn't be served quickly, and be eating a lot of lollies and growing fat.
Right, we're about to come to the end, so final question. We know, I guess, why you live in the cross. I guess it's to preserve your eternal youth. But tell us, why did you...
It's a drugs, man.
Well, we know what kind, then. Tell us, why did you decide to write about the cross? I mean, what drove you to write this book on the cross?
That's a very interesting question. Generally, I'm driven to write... something, especially non-fiction, is because I have to justify spending hours and hours, you know, just studying or reading. But with this one, I kept on looking around the cross and thinking, why hasn't there been a substantial book? And the more I studied the cross, I realised it was beyond these whole terms of notorious and red light. And you saw the architecture, and I realised that this sort of sense that was so progressive and such at the cutting edge of modernity, I thought, well, the rest of Australia should know this because it's changing and the history is going, and it needed to be done. And I was sort of driven by it. And also, to tell you the truth, I was driven by this thing of Kenneth Slessor. You know, I really hate it. I read all this stuff, and I'm going to go, I'm going to do better than you, Ken. I'm going to wipe your ass with it. I'm just going to do it. And but I wanted to do it in a different way because I realised I took a long time to realise if I did it in a completely chronological, linear way, King's Cross would be boring. It's not like that. So it's divided into threes all the time. One is the history. The second is like a flaneur. I go through one street after another about the history of the street and how I see it and how I relate to it. And the other thing is about themes, whether it's performing self or the history of Rene Rifkin, who made the great mistake one day of stopping his car in Victoria Street and there was a knock on his window and his life changed forever. And the cross does that to you, as it did do to Clive James recently, with a woman who lives in the cross. And you've got to one of the great things about the cross is the femme fatales. Rosalind Norton destroyed the career of Goossens. Clive James was almost destroyed by this woman. And so that history, that sort of sexiness, is interesting too.
Many thanks, Lou. Many thanks to Louis Nara for a fine performance tonight. It's fortunate the cross is physically so small because you've run up 15 pages covering 500 pages covering 11 streets, I think, so, which is quite an achievement. Look, this is a great book and a fine presentation tonight. Of course, Louis Nara is one of our finest writers, and he writes across so many fields, from fiction to non-fiction and more besides. But tonight we've seen him talking in a very funny and informative talk. Well done, and I hope the book goes well. There are copies here if anyone wants it. And for tonight, well done, Nara. We'll have you back in the future.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.